From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. Work makes many of us miserable. That's particularly true here in America, where we embrace working hard, being crazy busy, leaning in. We're encouraged to find meaning in work, to believe that we are defined by our work. My guest, Derek Thompson, writes in The Atlantic that work has morphed into a kind of religion here, promising identity, transcendence, and community. He calls this workism, and he argues that this gospel of work can't possibly deliver. This hour on Point, have we made work our new religion, and is it leaving us burnt out and spiritually empty? Join us. Do you seek meaning, something transcendent in your job? What's the cost? What's the emotional, physical, mental cost of dedicating your life to work? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from New York is Derek Thompson, writer at The Atlantic, who covers economics, labor markets, and the media. You can find a link to his piece, which is headlined, Workism is Making Americans Miserable. It's at our website, onpointradio.org. Derek Thompson, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and thanks for the provocative piece. It was really fun to read, and I think it's full of some really interesting stuff to chew on. So I want to sort of jump right in where you start. And you write that the economists of the early 20th century did not foresee that work might evolve from a means of material support to a means of identity production. So take us back to those early 20th century economists. How did they view work and what it should do for us?
So let's go back to the 1930s.
Yeah.
You're living through a time that is utterly fascinating. The economy is going through the second industrial revolution. Manufacturing is taking over. The farmland is declining as the center of the American identity for the workplace. And a lot of people are looking around and seeing all this change and wondering what's going to happen in the next 100 years, all right? In the last 100 years, we went from farms to factories. What happens in the next 100 years? And John Maynard Keynes, in this incredible essay called Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, he's thinking far out. He's thinking about us in 2019. He said, for the first time since his creation, man will be faced with his real permanent problem, how to occupy the leisure. Keynes thought that we'd be working 15-hour weeks. That we'd have not 5-day work weeks, but 5-day weekends. And you now go to, you look outside, do people have 5-day weekends?
Yeah,
no,
what happened? What happened with that great vision?
and this historical mystery is one of the things that launched me into this investigation. Yeah. What happened? Why was he wrong? And why do we work so much if we're so much richer and so much more productive than we were in the 1930s?
Right. Of course, some people, and I sort of want to say at the outset of this conversation, this feels like it's a great conversation to have. It's why we're having it. But it's also a conversation that I think a certain economic class can sort of afford to have in a way. I mean, a lot of people work because it's survival, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's a lot to think about in terms of, you know, what exactly did happen in the last 100 years. Well, first, working hours declined for most people.
Right.
As countries get richer, they almost always work fewer hours because, of course, what do you buy with more wealth? You tend to buy more leisure. But here's the second historical mystery that launched me into this quest and into this essay. Since the 1980s, only one group has dramatically increased its hours worked per week. It's not the poor. It's not the middle class. It's the rich.
Yeah, this is really
puzzling. That is the opposite of what we should have expected from the last 100 years. It's the rich who are working more than they used to be. And I wondered, you know, why are these men and women defying economic logic? And I thought, you know, maybe they're using their wealth to buy the strangest of prizes, which is more work, because work is the thing they have decided gives them meaning. They want to buy more work because work is who they are.
Yeah. So tell us how America, this group of Americans in particular, compares to other people in comparably developed societies. How much do we work? How much more do we work than, say, I don't know, folks in Italy, France, Spain, New Zealand, Australia? Go around the world. Pick your country.
The answer is we work more. No large country in the world that's as productive as the U.S. has more hours of work per year on average. And the gap between the U.S. and other countries is growing. I compared the U.S. in the research that I saw from the World Bank to countries like Germany and the Netherlands and Greece and Italy, as you mentioned. And the answer is that we work longer hours. We have shorter vacations. We orient public policy around the workplace so that we offer fewer retirement benefits, fewer unemployment benefits, fewer disability benefits, because we think it's valuable to keep as many people attached to the labor force working as much as possible. And so I do think that Americans have, in the last few decades, come to think of work as a kind of ersatz religion. And this right here is my thesis. You put it very well in your introductory summary. There was a time when I think Americans worked to live. But now it strikes me that Americans, and in particular the college-educated elite, we live to work. We've collectively, as an elite society, freighted work with expectations of meaning that are largely unrealistic and ultimately maybe a recipe for tremendous disillusionment and anxiety. You know, we tell people to pursue their passions, to hustle for their hobbies, to seek deep meaning in their day jobs. But then you look at the jobs that actually exist in the economy, and the jobs that exist were not invented to give us meaning. They were designed to sell things to people, to turn the gears of consumerism. And as I thought more and more about this phenomenon, thought about what we've come to expect from work, you know, community and meaning, transcendence, self-actualization, the irony that occurred to me, and the central irony of this piece, maybe the thesis of this piece, is that college graduate elites of the U.S. are less likely than any previous generation in this country's history to affiliate with the traditional religion. But they have funneled religious thinking into work itself. Their desks have become their altars. And I think that's a problem. When we worship work, we worship a God that doesn't care about us. We worship a God that has firing power. And though some of us may very well find jobs that have extraordinary meaning and offer us a gorgeous balance between work and life and meaning and self-actualization, for the vast majority of people, those jobs are so rare. I'm worried they're not going to find it. And I'm worried we are creating an expectation that is a recipe for mass disillusionment.
Really interesting. This connection with religion really interests me. But to what extent does sort of our religious tradition, and by that I guess I'm talking about Christian Protestantism in America, have to do with this? Because I was sort of trolling around on the internet and I found this prayer. So here's a prayer from the Bible. Thank you for Jesus's example of submission and service to your will. Forgive me when I forget my responsibility to be a servant of Jesus Christ. Then it goes on. Please help me to see my work as my primary place of witness. Help me to be disciplined so that I will work hard and internally respect those who have authority over me. In Jesus' name, amen. I mean, it's always been there, hasn't it? You've got to work. I mean, it was there in our religion.
Oh, that's a fabulous essay. And it's a great point that you do find elements of modern workism in Protestantism in particular.
Yeah.
That there is this idea that the way to honor God is through your work. And, you know, Max Weber has this fascinating theory where he says, in many ways, Christianity helped to create capitalism because, you know, if Protestantism encourages you to work really hard, but also says don't spend frivolously, then you have to save money. And if you save money, that money is going to go maybe to a bank, in which case it's going to be invested. And then bang, we've invented capitalism. We've invented financialization. We've invented the modern economy. So, of course, these ideas are old. But here's how I've begun to sort of think of it. And I am so grateful for all the people that have responded to this essay by pointing out its origins in the Protestant faith in particular. I think that modern workism is a product of the Protestant religion that is thriving in the modern secular world.
Huh.
Even though it was invented by people who believe very fervently in monotheism, the product actually has been exported to another world. Our world, a world where elites are less likely to be affiliated with the traditional religion, a world where they're less likely to be maybe they're spiritual, but they're less likely to call themselves Jewish or Christian or Muslim or Buddhist. And as a result, they need something to sit atop the altar of meaning. You know, if you take God off of the altar, something else has to go there. Maybe it's beauty. Maybe it's family. Maybe it's children. But for a lot of people, it's work. For a lot of people, it's career. And what I'm investigating here and what I'm seeking answers for, because I don't have them all, is what's the problem with that? And I think the problem with putting work at the top of this altar is that God is unfalsifiable. All right? If you believe in God, there's not going to be a fossil record that proves you wrong. That's one of the beauties, I think, of religion, is that it's a leap of faith.
Right.
But work is falsified all the time. Success is falsified all the time. Many of us are engaged in lotteries and sweepstakes that are zero-sum games. Only one person's going to get that EVP job. So if you make getting that executive vice president job your faith, you're putting your faith in a lottery. And by definition, lotteries disappoint the vast majority of their seekers. And so my worry here is that we are freighting work with burdens that work did not ask for and work cannot bear.
Really interesting. We're about to come up on a break, but let me ask you really quickly, is there evidence, or what's the evidence that you look at, that folks are disillusioned with this, that we are sort of, freighting work with too much searched for meaning and definition?
Sure. Let me give you three answers. Two are relatively empirical, and the third is a little bit more touchy-feely.
All right. Give me one, and then we'll do two more after the break.
Okay. All right, great. The first is what I said at the beginning, that the very fact that richer people are – those who can afford more leisure, those who can afford the most leisure are working more and more.
Right.
That says to me that they can buy anything they want in the world, and they're choosing to buy more hours of leisure. That's number one. Number two, the response to this essay is honestly – unlike anything I've ever written. It's hit a chord, and that's not science, that's anecdote, but enough anecdotes are something like data, and so I do believe that I'm on to something, even if we're just beginning to investigate what exactly it is that I'm on to.
Derek Thompson, I agree with you, and by looking at the number of calls we have on our screens, which we're going to be going to shortly, I think you're right. We're talking about this idea of workism and how our jobs have become an extension of our identity. You can join the conversation. Do we work too much, and do we expect too much from our work? I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about work and how our desire to find meaning in work may actually leave us spiritually unfulfilled. You can join the conversation. Does your job provide you with meaning, fulfillment? Does it give you an identity? Or is that belief system around work depleting you? If so, what's the answer? I'm talking with Derek Thompson, who's written in The Atlantic about this. You can find a link to his piece entitled Workism is Making Americans Miserable. That's at our website, onpointradio.org. And Derek, we've got a bunch of great calls, so I'd like to go to a couple right now, at least. Nico is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Go ahead, Nico. You're on the air. It's good to have you.
Hi, Nico. I mean, God.
You're Nico.
Sorry. I don't know who I'm talking to right now, obviously. Thank you so much. Just wanted to put in a brief little comment. I am so psychologically drained from just the whole idea that my work is who I am and my complete identity, and I think a lot of people feel that way. I personally work almost every day. I've recently only been able to take a couple of days off of the week just to spend time with me and myself. Over the holidays, I worked 90 days straight. And that's really just the typical life for me. I work, and that's just who I am. And it's even more prevalent on people see it on social media. You know, your worth is what you work, and vice versa. It's very stigmatizing. It's very overly draining, really, for a lot of people.
Nico, we got it. And you're a great example. Derek Thompson, there's a great example of what you're talking about, the first caller.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to pick up on the point about social media in particular.
Yeah.
I think that, There are some people who absolutely work their butts off and love it. They put their faith in their work and they found it. And I do think that those happy few do tend to be intrinsically motivated. They love what they do, and they don't need to you know, brag about it or publicize it. But maintaining the purity of internal motivations, I think, is harder in a world with social media, which externalizes everything. Where you go onto Twitter, you go onto Facebook, you go onto LinkedIn, and all of these sites are conspicuously marked with what I think of as the metrics of accomplishment, right? Followers and friends and viewers and retweets. And it turns all forms of communication into a competition. And in such a world, it becomes harder, I think, to hold on to the kind of internal motivations that make work most fulfilling. So I think that this caller has put a really fine point on the idea that workism intertwines with some of the dark sides of social media because it puts us in a tournament of labor. It makes us feel like we have to externalize our accomplishments all the time. And doing so, I think, makes us feel more anxious about whether or not we're succeeding because we look at people who are succeeding wildly whenever we log on. So I think this is a really important nexus to look at.
I think this focus as well, this focus on work and what do? You meet someone at a party, the first question they have, what do? In a way, you have to be on all the time, right? If the sort of first words out of your mouth to define yourself is about who you are professionally, it's kind of like you have to be working all the time.
It's really funny. So I used to live in Washington, D.C., and now I live in New York City. And in D.C., the first question at a party was always, what do? And in New York City, the joke when I moved to New York was that everyone said in New York, the first question is always, where do you live? the first question that we ask somebody at a party, that kind of small talk, is a reflection, I think, of what's top of mind, of, you know, what is the easiest entry into who this person is. And in New York, to a certain extent, I mean, New Yorkers, I think, are workists. But to a certain extent, because New York is so defined by neighborhoods and by the community of neighborhoods, you can make the first question something like, where do you live? And when someone says, you know, Bed-Stuy or Chelsea or the Upper East Side, that you can learn something about them. But it is so interesting that in so many cities and in so many classes of people, I mean, the easiest way to learn about someone is to ask them what they do. To a certain extent, this is kind of harmless. I'm very curious to know what people do. But it's a reflection of workism. It's a reflection of the fact that we have all quietly internalized the idea that the fastest way into a person's brain is through their resume.
Yeah. Let's go to Deborah, who's calling from Williamsburg, Virginia. Deborah, you're on the air. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a licensed professional counselor. I work with people in a mental health outpatient setting. I find my work to be very fulfilling, and it is a big part of my identity. That being said, I have recently made a move to cut back my hours and to be able to spend more time doing things that are ultimately just as satisfying and maybe a little bit more life-giving, things that include spending time with my elderly parents, working on arts and other creative activities. I kind of had to come to the conclusion that while I love my job, it doesn't really love me back. And
Deborah, that is a great point. Derek, I love that. I love my job, but it doesn't love me back.
I mean, what more can I say? That call was perfect. First, thank you to the
caller. It's not a loving God, right? Religion.
No, right. Thank you for what you do. What you do is so important. And I'm so happy that you found a way to do work that's both socially important, that fills your soul, but also that you've gained the perspective to know that a job that fills your soul is not your entire soul, that there's more to fill. And so you've done so by spending more time with family and doing things that make you happy. I mean, I can't imagine a more beautiful confluence of work and life.
Let me introduce a couple more guests to get a couple more voices into this conversation. Joining us now from Dallas, Texas, is Emily Estefani Smith, a writer and journalist and the author of the 2017 book, The Power of Meaning, Finding Fulfillment in a World Obsessed with Happiness. Emily Estefani Smith, welcome to On Point. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us via Skype from Philadelphia is Adam Grant. He's a professor of management and psychology at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. His research focuses on meaningful work, motivation, and leadership. He's the host of a podcast called Work Life and author of several books dealing with this topic. Adam Grant, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Anthony.
Let me start with you, Emily. What do you hear in Derek's thesis and probing question here?
It's great to be on the call with Derek and Adam. I really admire both of your work. So I agree with Derek that there is definitely something going on here, people investing a lot of themselves in their work. However, I also agree with him that, you know, we shouldn't be worshiping false idols. But I think I disagree with him slightly about what the false idol is that people are worshiping. I think that, you know, work is not necessarily the problem. People have always turned to work for a source of meaning. If you think about one of the earliest jobs, you know, forms of work that there was, hunting, there were rituals around that. Primitive man, the cave paintings, 30,000 years old, were all about these rituals surrounding the hunt. So we've always looked to work for meaning. I think what the false idol is and what this neuroses is that we're seeing, especially among the highly educated, is creating an idol out of success, ambition, and status mongering. And so you have these people who are working and working and choosing to work. They don't have to work these hours. And I think it's because they are this part of our psyche that yearns for meaning has been co-opted outside of religion, outside of our civic communities, with this ceaseless quest for success.
Interesting. So success, ambition, status mongering. I mean, what should the focus be instead? Joy, personal joy, intellectual inquiry, things like values like that?
You know, when I was researching and reporting on my book, The Power of Meaning, one of the most eye-opening experiences I had again and again was when I talked to people about their work, the people who seem to not have all of this existential dread, all of this burnout and misery with respect to their work were people who were working what we might call blue-collar jobs. So I spoke to a woman named Candace who was a hospital cleaner, and she said, you know, my job isn't to clean bedpans. It's to help sick people heal. I spoke recently separately to a barbershop owner in Baltimore who, he told me standing outside of his barbershop, you know, I've owned this shop for 30 years before me. My mother owned it and my uncle. And now I see the kids walk by, I go out and I talk to them, they know that I'm here, I love what I do, and he has such a sense of pride around it. And I think that we can learn from these people and see that there's something about playing a role in your community and connecting what you do to something bigger that that does fill the soul.
Adam Grant, I'd love to get your reaction as well. And let me start with you with just the question. Isn't there something noble about the idea that we are defined by our work?
No, of course not. Definitely not. Derek, I love the article. I thought it was fascinating. But I think the problem is that work is seen as something noble in and of itself. It dates back to Martin Luther and the Protestant ethic, where, you know, work was your duty from God. But I think it's morphed into this thing where grit is seen as a virtue. And I don't think there's anything virtuous about grit. With all due respect to Marie Kondo, I'm not going to applaud you if you're really hardworking in organizing your closet, right? I think that grit is a virtue if the ends are virtuous. And so I think we're doing way too much celebrating of people who are hustlers and hard workers, when instead we should be asking, well, what are you working toward? And does that purpose really matter?
Interesting. With Adam, let me stick with you. With regard to work, what does the research tell us about the relationship between this quest for happiness and fulfillment and actually becoming happy and fulfilled?
Oh, there's some really fun studies led by Iris Maus at Berkeley, where she shows that the more you value happiness, the less happy you often become.
Oh, that's interesting.
And you can even show that with experiments where you just get people to think about why happiness is kind of the ultimate currency in their lives. And then they often become more miserable. And it seems like chasing happiness ends up sort of chasing it away. And part of that is because you set an impossible standard. And, you know, you're sort of looking for nirvana in a job. And, you know, the higher your expectations are, the greater the chance that you're disappointed. But part of that is also when you're looking for extreme happiness, you're constantly evaluating what your job is like. And so it's really easy to say, well, this isn't nirvana yet, so I must not be in the right place. And you never really engage with the job to experience it, to find flow. And it makes it really hard then for you to feel like you got the job you wanted.
Derek, Adam, Emily, stand by. I want to go to some calls. Listeners, we're talking about a great piece by Derek Thompson in The Atlantic where he writes about, his piece is called Workism is Making America Miserable. You can find it at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's go to Amy. She's calling from Miami. Hi, Amy. Go ahead. Thanks for the call.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I find this subject to be extremely important. I speak about it a lot. I'm an occupational therapist. And I work with children, and their most meaningful occupation is play. And even though the research shows that play with adults and children makes them more productive and happy, what I see is that we're really pushing this idea of work, 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 work into really young children, so much so that we're pushing them beyond what their developmental expectations should be and causing them to not like to learn and to not like to work. And so I just wanted to add that into the conversation because I feel, even as a therapist, I'm getting more and more referrals for children who are 3 and 4 years old because they're not producing at a level that's above what they should be able to.
Wow. Emily, what do you hear in Amy's call there? I mean, that's really Amy, thank you for that call. I think it's a hugely important point. But hearing about 3 and 4 year olds being referred to therapists because they're not producing what they need to produce, oh, my God, this makes me sad for all of us.
It is. It's heartbreaking. And I think it's, you know, part of this neurosis that Derek writes about, where part of the problem is that our worth as human beings is defined by how productive we are. So our value is being defined by how much value we're adding to society. And parents feel an enormous amount of pressure to get their children on that path where, you know, funneling them into a path where, you know, they get into the right schools, get to the right jobs. And so I think that children are kind of being deprived of childhood because there's this very strong cultural pressure to define our identities and our sense of worth by how successful we are in our careers.
Derek, I'm just wondering, isn't the flip side of this obsessive commitment to work, isn't it disengagement, idleness, no communion with our fellow citizens? Isn't that equally dangerous?
Let me start by backing up just a little bit and say something that is entirely sincere and true. Whenever I'm writing an article, particularly a long piece, I always carry on a kind of silent dialogue in my head with potential critics who are scrutinizing the sentences and saying, really? Are you sure about that? And I kid you not, two of the people I was thinking of when I was writing this essay were Adam and Emily. So it is incredible and only slightly terrifying to have the voices in my head now literally in my head. To the direct question, there is a lot of room between putting your work on a pedestal and, to use Emily's beautiful phrase, status mongering, and being entirely disengaged from your job. In fact, it goes right to the research that Emily touched on, that for many years you had, you know, blue-collar workers who were engaged their job that could experience what the psychologist Csikszentmihalyi called flow, this beautiful sense of being deeply engaged with your work. You can experience that while still thinking the thing that defines me is my family, the thing that defines me is my community service, the thing that defines me is my children. And so you don't have to conflate the idea of engagement with work with the kind of quasi-spiritual worship thereof.
Derek, you honestly confessed in this piece that you are the very thing that you are criticizing.
Yeah, I am.
Explain that.
Yeah, this was writing this piece was, I suppose, the cheapest possible therapy one can buy. It was unbelievably. I felt like I was getting a very transparent look into my motivations and the way that I think about work. And, you know, to be honest, yeah, I am a workist. I'm exactly what I'm criticizing. I do draw extraordinary amounts of meaning from my work, and when my work isn't fulfilling me, it bleeds over into every other part of my life. At the same time, you know, to take a broad perspective here, I'm really lucky. I'm paid to think and write stuff. I mean, that's a really rare job. And to the extent that we are in the business of coming up with to thinking about ways that culture is organized, I can't pretend that being paid to think and write for a living is like a mainstream position. It's nothing like the vast majority of jobs. And my fear is that we are creating expectations for work that are unrealistic given the jobs that actually exist in the economy. And so that's why I wanted to write the piece.
Listeners, we're talking about how work has morphed into an extension of ourselves, a kind of religion called workism. You can join the conversation. What do you think of that? We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back, continue our conversation. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're taking a hard look at workism, the gospel of work, this idea that our jobs give us so much meaning, identity, and a sense of who we are in our community. We're talking with Derek Thompson, whose piece in The Atlantic is entitled Workism is Making Americans Miserable. We're also joined by University of Pennsylvania psychologist Adam Grant and author and journalist Emily Esfahani Smith. Let's go to Neil, who's calling from Tampa Bay, Florida. Neil, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. This couldn't be any more prescient. You know, I'm between jobs right now. I stopped a job last month, a pretty big job, CEO, and I start my new one in March, and I decided to take February off. That was a big mistake.
Because?
Completely different. Well, a completely different thought emerges when you aren't on that merry-go-round on the treadmill. You start hearing different voices and seeing things differently. To take some time, I went to French Polynesia, and I was there with a bunch of other, you know, people at a very nice place, and they were all on their cell phones, and they were all doing their emails, and they were supposed to be on vacation. I wasn't, because I was between jobs. I didn't have anything to answer to, and I think that was a very big difference there.
So, Neil, let me ask you, when you go back to your new job, do you think you're going to bring a different attitude toward this new job, maybe balance it more with life off the job or something like that?
I would say caution. I think something Adam said earlier was pretty prescient, or I don't know whether it was Derek, but it was, you know, that jobs weren't invented to bring people meaning. They were invented to sell things. So I think I'm just going to be a little more cautious. I think there's job creep, you know, your things creep into your job, but I think there's meaning creep too. And I think we just ascribe meaning to jobs because that's what we're told to do. That's what we're expected to do. It's the LinkedIn thing. It's the evaluation by, you know, what you are is what you do. And it's a really dangerous mindset, but it's pervasive and it's hard to get out of.
Neil, thanks so much for that great call. We really appreciate it. Let's take another one. Kit is calling from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Kit, you're on the air. Great to have you.
Hi, thank you. My comment is kind of just simple. I guess as you were looking at work as a religion, I guess my question is, so if a person isn't working, then they must be a sinner, because that's translating into all of our society. And those that aren't working, who are struggling to make it and can't find a job or are to the point where they've given up and haven't looked for a job, it's affecting the social programs and how people look at those programs. And that's kind of where I'd like to end.
Kit, no, I really appreciate it. Derek Thompson, pick up on that. I want to go around the table here. I'll start with you, Derek. But Kit puts a provocative idea on the idea of on the table. If work is religion and folks aren't working, then are they sinners? I think that's so interesting.
Oh, I think it's a fascinating point. And we don't need to make this conversation overly political, but I think that to the extent that workism is an elite credo, it's one that is consecrated from the Marble Diocese of Congress and enshrined into law. I mean, most advanced countries, give new parents paid leave. The U.S. does not. Most advanced countries ease the burden of parenthood with national policies to do so. The U.S., however, spends less on child care and early education than almost any other country in the OECD. Where do we get health care in the U.S.? From our jobs. Half of us do, at least, and most of us between the age of 18 and 65. So in many ways, workism is the law. It is something that is pushed into public policy. And so it's not just a private religion. It is a public policy. And I think that it's important to think about, therefore, how changes in attitudes among those who subscribe to this faith might result in changes in public policy that could help all of us lead more well-balanced lives.
Interesting. Emily, what's the answer here? Do we need to get back to the idea that working is more a means to an end? We work to pay the rent, to support our kids, to buy time, to pursue our hobbies and the things that we truly love.
I think I think a balanced approach to work makes a lot of sense. But I think I probably want to push back against my esteemed colleagues on this panel and really make a case for work being ennobling. So yes, I agree with Derek that part of a capitalist system is that work and labor are ways to sell things. But I also think that in a capitalist system, every job and every piece of labor and everything that's being created is being created to fill some sort of need in the world. And, Adam brought in Martin Luther, and the idea that work is a calling, as Adam pointed out, really comes from Luther. And he's the first one to introduce this idea in the West that your work can, and whatever you do, whether you're a cobbler or an accountant, that there is a sense of meaning in your work. And it wasn't just because God has given you a duty to work. Luther said it was also because the work that you do benefits mankind. It contributes to the well-being of mankind. And I think that it's important to remember that all work that we do fills some need in the world. And therefore, when we work, it is this noble thing that we're doing.
It's interesting, and I'm going to read a comment off our Facebook page that's sort of related to this idea that goes back in time. Salvation writes, "How do you support work as a new source of identity? Given the number of people named after their family's traditional occupation, isn't every Smith, Taylor, Goldsmith, Schumacher, Baker, etc. proof that work has been a source of identity for countless generations?" I like that comment. But Adam Grant, respond to some of what Emily just said.
Well, I think work is definitely noble if your work has a real impact on others. But I think too many people don't have the luxury of working in jobs that have a meaningful, lasting effect on others, right? So for every person who gets to build a car that somebody else drives or who gets to perform a surgery where life and death are on the line, there are lots of people who feel like their work is completely trivial. Think about the large numbers of people who are servers at restaurants, for example. If their individual job didn't exist, would people be that much worse off? Maybe not. Think about how many people work as cashiers or who work in, sales jobs where they feel like they don't believe in their products. And I think that's a huge problem. And I think we have a responsibility as a society to design jobs that, as Studs Terkel would have put it, are actually large enough for our spirit.
Wow. That's a great comment. I'm glad you referred to Studs Terkel there. Let's go to Joseph, who's calling from Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Joseph, it's good to have you on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. First, to Emily, by the way, would you like fries with that in terms of value in the workplace? But separately, to address your main guest, I could not agree with him more. I think I kind of love him. He's brought up a topic that I think is vitally important. I lived in Europe for several years, and their perspective on work is dramatically different. But I wanted to mention that in 1980, there was a conference, a national conference in Chicago of municipal planners, and they were asked at the time what they thought the number one issue confronting us as citizens would be in the year 2000 from that perspective of 1980. And the answer they came up with was, how would we fill the leisure hours that the average individual would possess because they would only be working 1 or 2 days a week? And it was really a different vision of what they saw automation and computers and technology would bring. And nowadays, of course, we talk about the possibility of a guaranteed basic income. And I'm curious what Derek thinks about that, because, you know, we're looking at the real possibility, not of people having the option to work one or two days a week, but of having no choice but to have very little, if any, work in many situations.
Joseph, thanks. Derek, what do you think about these policies like guaranteed basic income, like guaranteed childcare, no college debt, all these things that contribute to the requirement that we work, 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 work?
Yeah, I think a part of being a professional economic commenter today is having a really firm opinion on universal basic income. And that makes me a terrible economic commenter, because I don't have a very strong opinion about universal basic income. My feeling is, let's see. You know, Finland is doing an experiment on it. Alaska, to a certain extent, has been doing an experiment on it for a while. There are trials happening all over the world. Let's see what happens. I'm open to the possibility that UBI helps people, and even that UBI might become necessary in a world where automation and AI and other technologies permanently erode the workforce such that there is a large swath of people who cannot be meaningfully connected to the economy. One more thing that I guess I just want to say is that I think that Emily and I are in many ways in strong agreement. We're just using slightly different terms. I think, you know, to Adam's point, you know, the majority of jobs in the U.S. are the most common occupations in the U.S., I should say, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, are cashiers, salespeople, food and beverage clerks, and waiters. You know, these are jobs that are not typically thought of as pursue your passion jobs. But we shouldn't lose respect for ordinary work. We shouldn't practice soft contempt for ordinary work. Those jobs should have a certain dignity, even if those people who are working in them wish to leave them. That, in fact, that our dignity for the workers should in some way be disconnected from the thing they happen to be doing at this time in their life. And to achieve that end, you do have to separate some public policies from the labor force and say some things are guaranteed to everybody by sheer virtue of them being a human being who is a citizen of this country, like, say, a certain amount of money every month, like, say, universal health care, like, say, universal child care if you have a young kid. That these sort of policies, I think, would reflect a dignity for humans that is not impossibly intertwined with the labor force.
Interesting. Emily?
So I want to make a distinction. So there's a distinction between feeling that your work is a calling and between feeling like your work has meaning. So about 30% of people we know from the research have this calling orientation towards their work. That doesn't mean that the remaining 70% of us won't find meaning in our work. And I, you know, to Joseph's point, would you have fries with that? I just want to hit back against that a little bit. And this kind of broader idea in our culture that there are certain kinds of jobs that are, you know, tedious and that don't actually confer meaning with telling a story. So a friend of mine a few years ago went to McDonald's, and he, you know, he had forgotten his wallet at home or something and didn't have any money. And the cashier brought him the food, and he didn't have the money. And he was like, "Oh, well, I'm sorry, I don't have it. I'll just, you know, I'm sorry to trouble you with your time." And she looked at him and she said, she handed him the food, and she said, "My job is to feed you." And she gave him that food. And so I think, you know, our mindset towards our work really defines how much meaning we bring to our work and how much meaning we derive from it, regardless of whether that work is a calling for us or not.
Let's take at least one more call. James is calling from Newport News, Virginia. Go ahead, James. You're on the air. Thanks for the call. Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to point out that, so over the decades, we've had this move from an industrial economy to this information age. And as a financial planner, I know my clients don't pay me necessarily for my time. They pay me for my knowledge and my intellect in my field. And because we're talking about knowledge and intellect, those are things that are internalized in their mind. And I wonder if that drives a lot of the relationship that we're talking about today.
Interesting, James. What do you think, Adam? Can you respond to James?
Look, I think the information age exists, but I actually think we got that wrong in the sense that most of us don't work in the knowledge economy. We actually work in the service economy. Go back to those jobs that Derek was talking about. Over 80% of Americans work in service jobs. where, you know, yes, there's some information that you have to share, but ultimately your job is to please a client or satisfy a customer. And so I think that that's where a lot of these problems come into play is in the manufacturing economy, you had a tangible product and you could see the result of your work. And Derek, you wrote about this in the article. Whereas oftentimes now in a service economy, we don't know our ultimate impact and we're stuck in the dark.
Interesting. Derek, I want to come back to this idea and sort of talk to you as your role as an economic commentator, which you referred to a moment ago. I mean, you make the point in this piece that we have sort of enshrined workism in our laws and our policies. And I'm sort of I'm puzzled by that because, for instance, if you look at the way something like universal health care or specifically Medicare for All polls, in a lot of polls, a majority of Americans say they're in favor of that. My guess is something like debt-free college, affordable child care, which is being talked about out on the campaign trail, the presidential campaign trail now, would poll pretty well as well. So Americans seem inclined to embrace these programs, to favor these programs that would give them more leisure. And yet, as you point out in this piece, sort of year after year, generation after generation, we seem to be enshrining policies that that favor workism. And I'm puzzled by what seems to be a contradiction there.
Yeah, it's a fascinating contradiction. And I'm not sure I understand it entirely, although I do think it's uncontroversial to say that in the last 20 years, welfare policies have been more and more tied to the workplace. In 1996, President Clinton signed the Welfare Reform Act,
right,
which replaced much of the existing welfare system with programs that didn't just give money to people who were poor, but made those benefits contingent on employment. That's thing number one. Thing number two, though, is that I'm still working out this story, but to a certain extent, I think millennials, those born between the early 1980s and late 1990s, were indoctrinated in this ethos of workism. And you see that this generation has moved sharply left in the last few years. It's probably the most left-leaning generation of voters in American history. There's a theory from sociology called the revolution of rising expectations. And the revolution of rising expectations says that most revolutions in world history tend to come not from the poor or from the very rich. It tends to come from a disappointed upper middle class, people who thought that things were going to get better, but reality fell behind expectations. And to a certain extent, maybe that's what we're seeing in the capitalist economy, is that a certain generation of people grew up expecting that the labor market, sort of motivated as it is by global capitalism, would give them jobs that would feed their souls. And then they got the jobs that were available to 20-somethings, and those jobs are not designed to feed souls often. And so I think that a lot of the political revolution that we're seeing might actually have a bit of its origin in the disillusionments from workism.
Really interesting. Derek Thompson, thank you so much for your piece. We really appreciate it. And thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a great pleasure having you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. And thanks to Adam and Emily for their really, really insightful comments as well.
Yes, Adam Grant from the Horton School at the University of Pennsylvania and Emily Esfahani Smith. So glad to have you with us as well. Thank you both. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.